So what's it like for each of us? And late in the piece today, I was thinking, what did we say we were going to talk about? I went online and I saw the line, compassionate presence, wise response, and I thought, well, that's a relief. That it feels so in the flow of the retreat Jitendra and I have just been teaching at Cloud Mountain. That it doesn't feel like, oh, people are going to be expecting something else, because we talk really just from whatever arises in our own heart, mind, in response to the room. So it can be a bit precarious if the theme is supposed to be somewhere else and it's just not resonant. So this aspect of compassionate presence became more and more focal for me over the days of the retreat. Not that it isn't there anyway, but it became just so much front and center as I was contemplating the sense of how critical the cultivation of the heart is, that we have the willingness, we have the capacity, we have the love to be with what is arising, what's present for us, what's our experience, and what that makes possible, both in terms of our own waking up and in terms of our response to others, to the world. And because we can only see, we can only wake up to, we can only awaken to what we are present to. So really this is the Four Noble Truths that the Buddha taught. For those of you that are familiar with that framework, that was a real teaching about what is the medicine for the way we can feel so stressed and afflicted and troubled. And this very fundamental teaching points us back to here, to what is actually happening. To come out of the running, coming out of the avoiding, coming out of pretending it's not going on, and feeling, knowing, this ability to just open to, soften. So it's the unfolding, the releasing of the heart doesn't happen without the heart being generous, kind, compassionate. So it's helpful, I find, to really recognize that, to cultivate these qualities, to allow them to become great, boundless, strengthened. They're not something off on the side that we just do metta practice or we do Brahma Vihara practice sometime. They're as essential, as fundamental. They're actually mindfulness. Because they are about being present, about knowing. So this quality of compassionate presence. So when the Buddha first started teaching, he said, and it was very clear, he only taught out of compassion. So the teachings were given as medicine to us for for what afflicts us. So, as we were inquiring at the end of the retreat, is it possible to receive them, to use them as contemplation tools, as ways to understand our lives in that same way, that we pick them up kindly, compassionately, that we don't pick them up with them as ways we judge ourselves, ways we feel ourselves failing. There's a whole proliferation of things we're failing at. And it's so important that our spiritual life is lived from a place of love. Otherwise, we get disheartened. And our willingness falls away. So reflecting over this time on the cultivation, and one of the fundamental ways the Buddha talked about the qualities for awakening were these, the fact that this quality of faith was essential. And what is the faith in? It's not just faith that the sun will come up tomorrow. It's a very specific kind of faith, and it's really the faith that we have the capacity to wake up, to come out of the affliction of ill will, of the proliferating mind, that we have the capacity to be here with the way it is. This tremendous confidence we can have that whatever is going on, we can actually meet it. We can awaken to it. We can awaken with it. It can be our door to the deathless. So having, cultivating, really feeling our capacity is critical. That here we are, we come, most of you had other things you could have been doing, but you make the effort, you give up the time, you do what it takes to get to places of practice, to do meditation, to do so many things that are bringing benefit. And so it's important that we drink this in. We actually hold a mirror up to ourselves and recognize we are cultivating. We are living generously. We are living ethically. We are committed to this spiritual inquiry, and it may even, can take so many shapes, can't it? Now I'm speaking from a Buddhist perspective, but this spiritual inquiry can be from all kinds of different frameworks. But it's still, we are committed to freeing our mind from what afflicts us and causes us to bring affliction to others. So it's a dynamic. I remember years ago, maybe when I was first at the monastery, having this really tearing feeling inside. I don't know what I'd done, but this tearing feeling that, if I could only free my heart from any kind of hatred, any kind of, and this is subtle, it wasn't like I was hating, but I'd been a bit sharp. And you really feel it sometimes, don't you, when you've been a bit tight with somebody, and this great wish not to be doing that. to living in a way that wasn't hurting. And I know each of you will share that, that we want to live lives that are bringing blessing. And to really see that in ourselves, that it keeps us with this faith, this sense of, yes, we are waking up, we are committed. We are committed to our own welfare and happiness. We are committed to the welfare of happiness of those around us, our families, our friends, our community. I imagine a great proportion of you are involved in work that is spreading out across this whole globe. We come from the mighty empire of America, and a sense of how, you know, the whatever is good spreads out, and certainly we can see the benefit of your cultivation all the way down in New Zealand. We have people who have cultivated come share the teachings. We have people who have trained within the different practice communities. Come like a wave, you know, out across the world. You know, the amount of Dharma practitioners, you know, lay Dharma practitioners that are maturing within this country is amazing. But because you live within it, you can mistake it. You really see it when you come from where I come from. Sitting on the retreat with people that had gathered, just the quality of willingness and settledness, and just how kind everybody was. And no one's talking really. Well, a few are talking a little, I guess, but subtly, and just making the tiniest gestures that we, the rest of us, can drink in and take heart from. Someone is spontaneously making sure the lights work. Someone else is looking after something else. And how we can gain heart by noticing each other, what each of us are doing. Someone is looking after the recording tonight, someone sets up the cushions. It's about drinking in this field we dwell within. And it's not to deny some of the turmoil happening in the larger field. This is life, after all. It's dynamic and mixed, but it's to really notice the wholesome, what is good, and take heart. This quality that hatred only ceases with love. That we really make our compassion, our love, very strong. And what, in my experience, when we can rest in that capacity, everything starts changing. If you can actually be fully here with this kind, compassionate, loving quality, for first it starts here with our own experience. Everything starts unraveling. Unraveling of the affliction, of the self-grasping tightness. You can feel it in your body, can't you, as you sit in meditation a day, you've got more and more like this. And as you sit, I can hear my back cracking and opening and the whole thing just starting to relax and open. And this is the possibility of the practice, isn't it? We come out of the contraction of grasping, wanting, not wanting, into an open place where we're willing to be here. And how much more lovely that feels. So it's for our own well-being, and it also spreads out. And from that open, generous place, response happens. You'll all have seen it. You know, you're up all night worrying and thinking, and you get plans and ideas. But of course, they're the plans of the worried mind. They're the plans of the resentful mind. You know, they're filled with that delusion. And so we can spend ages thinking about things from the kind of afflictions of the heart. But when we wake up out of that, when the worry goes or the resentment goes, we realize these plans were crazy. They were just born out of that same negativity. So to free the heart of this afflicted quality of the not wanting, wanting, the kind of this kind of dynamic into just a simple, upright presence, then when we respond, it doesn't come with all this additional affliction. We have more sense from where we sit of what might be helpful. So we're more capable of blessing. So the work is always to inquire what allows me to be here, what's needed to calm, settle, steady the mind, soften, open, come fully into reality and engagement, response happens from there. So this is a big topic that I'm just touching on the edges of. It'd be lovely to hear Jitendra's reflections and really to allow most of the time for questions. So just a few thoughts to really start to prime our conversation. So thank you.
So you're all mostly just silhouetted for me at the moment, looking into the bright twilight behind you. To continue on from Willa's reflections, can you hear me? Can everyone hear me okay? Just to reflect in this space about compassionate presence, wise response. They're big words, really, aren't they? Compassionate presence, wise or wisdom. They're big words, and they're obviously everyone here are interested in those things. What do they mean? It's something that the heart can rise up to, you know, in the instance of hearing them. They sound nice. Sounds like something I want, something that would be nice to live with. But what do they really mean? Compassionate presence, wise response. And obviously talking within the context of the Buddha's teaching, they mean, to me at least, particular movements. Particular movements. And for those who are meditators, who are committed to a path of meditation, they will mean something to each of us. So I'll share a bit from my own experience over the years. Certainly the Buddha's teaching is goes right to the heart of the human experience. Getting a little bit of feedback there. He goes to the heart of the human experience with a teaching about suffering and the end of suffering. This is something that, as human beings, we all experience suffering, and we're all very interested in finding a way to freedom from suffering. So he's captured our attention straight away. We can resonate with that as well. So what is this experience of suffering? And we can experience it in many, many ways, from the merest agitation of mind or body to the other end of spectrum of great despair or severe pain and all the stuff in between. We all know what suffering is about, and even that existential angst of not knowing this opportunity of life we have, we don't know what it's about, what to do with it. The classic existential questions: where do I come from? Who am I? How's the best way to live this life? These kind of questions come from not knowing the truth of the matter, and so they get us searching. And so the Buddha's teaching around suffering and the end of suffering is first bringing our attention to this experience of suffering for a good reason. We all know that we're suffering, but we don't understand what it is in terms of our own experience. We think we do. We all know we suffer when we suffer, right? But we don't fully understand how it's happening and how to be free of it. Because the Buddha clearly stated it is possible to be free of suffering. For most of us, we get caught in a bit of a spin, trying to get away from our experiences of suffering, trying to fix them up, trying to plaster them over, suppressing, ignoring, or going full head on into trying to understand it, which is what the path of meditation, Buddha's practice, is about. So we come into a place, the whole path of meditation is first to learn some sense of presence, how to really be with this experience of body-mind in order to understand what's happening here. What is this human experience of being? So here we actually, we first begin to learn about presence, what it is to be present, what it is to be not present, what it is to be struggling with trying to be present. As soon as we attempt to be present, what we notice is everything that's not being present, trying not to be here, just the patterns of the mind, and also of the body, the restlessness. Often we don't want to be still. So the first thing we confront often in trying to be present is that which is not able to be present, which is very much linked to this first truth, the noble truth of suffering, which is the most common human experience. So how can we be present with that? Actually, we begin to notice that there's an automatic habitual movement away from this experience of pain. Again, whether it's just a sense of restlessness or agitation, or those bigger pains that we experience, some emotional pain of loss, grief, the mental pain we might experience from time to time or regularly, depending on what's coming up in our lives, and the physical pain with severe illness or disease. How can we be present with that? And this is really where our learning begins to unfold in the Buddhist path. Because he said, and encouraged us quite clearly, we need to understand suffering before we can understand how to be free of it, or before we can even experience freedom from it. We need to understand what's happening here. So our cultivation, our path cultivation, is one of learning how to be present with pain often, isn't it? With agitation, with restlessness, with things that we consider for ourselves that aren't right, that aren't good, that are difficult to be with. And as Willow was saying, we need to be able to cultivate some heart qualities to help us be with that which is difficult to bear. One translation of the Buddhist word dukkha, that which is difficult to bear. Those heart qualities of kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy and equanimity. This is a big part of the cultivation of Buddhist skills, both towards ourselves and towards others. But firstly, we have to understand how to cultivate that towards this experience of being. So compassionate presence, what does it mean to be compassionately present? Compassion, one literal translation, is to feel with suffering. To feel with. So already it's leaning us into the direction that's away from that tendency to pull away from the pain, but to be able to stand with it and feel with that pain. What is that pain? We can ask this question in our own hearts when we're sitting meditation. Sometimes for some of us who've been practicing for a while, it's easy. Well, it's easier to rest into a state of presence. That's because we develop some skill of how to recognize restless mind, restless body, pain here, fleeing feeling there, another thought of the future there. We recognize these things and we're gently able to bring the mind back, not through suppressing or ignoring or judging these things that want to move away, but actually just recognizing, just recognizing that movement just as it is, and recognizing the pain, subtle sensations of pain, whether in the body or the heart, underneath those attempts to flee from the moment. You can always find a subtle feeling, tone or sensation of something unpleasant that's hard to be with. But yet when we bring that into focus, when we bring our awareness to recognize that, something marvelous happens. Suddenly we can, through that recognition, we can be with that experience. And in that moment of truly being with it, it shows a transformation. What we're able to see and be present with, it shows its true nature. And part of that true nature is to change. It shows this experience is not permanent. It actually changes. Whether it's sensation in the body, feeling tone, a mood, an idea, a thought, even the notion of a thought about me or mine, I'm like this or he's like that. If we really are present and see that thought just for what it is and the feelings that follow upon it, if we're present with that, willing to be present, willing to be awake to that, which goes against the habit of mind, which is either to run with the thoughts or run away from the thoughts. By running with the thoughts, we perpetuate a particular story. By running away from painful emotions or feelings, we set up a resistance. But by coming into direct relationship with those things in the moment, with clear knowing, with an ability to calm the mind enough to stay with and be present, something changes. We understand something in that moment. And this is the place where wisdom arises, where understanding arises. So this notion of compassionate presence is vital to wise response. Wisdom is not something that comes from an idea. It's not a good idea that we hang on to and try to cultivate from the conceptual mind. Wisdom is a knowledge that arises in the heart, a direct seeing. And particularly in the Buddhist tradition, wisdom is the kind of knowledge that leads us to freedom from suffering, either in the moment or as a consequence of, as a result of our seeing clearly. So these two are very closely related, compassion and wisdom, often expressed as two sides of the same coin or the two faces of the Buddha, wisdom and compassion. They, you know, two sides of the hand, they truly cannot be separated. Now, as much as we love the notions of wisdom, of compassion, of kindness, of equanimity, I know that we all know in this room we can't make them happen from an idea. We can't make ourselves feel those things, and the times when we realize that is when someone's really pushed our buttons. Yeah? It's like I can think I'm a very kind and compassionate person for the most part, and someone comes along and says something and they've found a button. And what does that do to your idea of I'm a kind and compassionate person? Especially if, you know, that button that got pushed leads into a quick response in speech that might be a little unkind or worse. And then you're, where did that come from? That doesn't fit my image. Pack it away. But actually we should really investigate that. That's actually a place we need to see clearly what happened there. You know, many of us will go into self-blame. I'm terrible, terrible person for saying that or doing that. Or if we don't have the habit of self-blame, we might blame externally, blame everyone else or the powers that be. But really, the Buddhist path is actually to come deeply inside and have a look, what's going on in there? What was that about? What was that button about? What was that thing that got pushed? What was my experience in that moment? Something felt painful. If you come down to it, in that moment, no matter what was said, and this is just an example, no matter what was said, you know, it's actually a very good euphemism, isn't it? Push my button. When our buttons are being pushed, we all know what that means. It elicits a painful response of some form. And we need to know, if we want to truly know how to be free from suffering, we need to understand what that painful response is about, and we need to know where we're feeling it and when we're feeling it. Can we develop that presence of mind that can be really there when the button is pushed? And you have the spaciousness to see what arises from that. And yet know it just for what it is. Present enough to allow it to arise, to be seen, and to mutate, to change as it does, to change into something else. It may just be a moment, a fleeting moment of reactivity. We can see it for what it is. And then we have the spaciousness to respond rather than just being caught in reaction. The spaciousness, mindfulness cultivates that spaciousness to be able to consider, even in a split second, what's the best response here? And to take your time with that. Is it a good time to respond or is it a not good time to respond? Can I respond kindly even though something felt hurt? Or do I have to flag that maybe we need to come back to this, or that didn't feel kind? There's this space to actually contemplate. It's very, it sounds a lot when you put it into words. It sounds like you need, I'll need a whole 10 minutes before I can wisely respond, thank you, so back off. But actually with mindfulness and wisdom, the wisdom that develops, it can happen in a few milliseconds. You can understand through cultivation what wise response is. And of course, wise response is that which is conducive to the allaying of suffering for self and other. Perhaps an unwise response, if we're to generally think about it, and everything, you know, you can't just take general platitudes and lay them over every situation. But in general terms, we're encouraged to reflect on speech and action in terms of, is this going to be of benefit, of wholesome benefit to self and other? Or is it going to be the potential harm to self and other? This is the basic reflection. So wisdom and compassion is very much connected to our understanding of harm. Harm and harmlessness. When it comes to our emotional world, which is dictates so much of our response in the world, in the world of relationships, how can we be with those painful emotions that we experience without denying, without suppressing, without judging, and yet without reacting? That compassionate presence we need to develop in relation to this heart's experience. How can I be with painful experiences such as grief and loss, or anger, rage? Judgment doesn't help. We often get caught in judgment about these things and try to talk ourselves out of them, which can help in some ways, but have we really met that feeling in the heart? In my experience and in my practice, there's a need to develop that capacity to be present with all the moods of the mind, all the moods of the heart, to really feel with them, whether they're painful or pleasurable, whether they're technically good or bad, or right or wrong, positive or negative. We need to be able to be present with those just as they are. And that presence of mind that allows a full awareness, a full clarity and potential to look into that experience, to investigate what is that made up of in my own experience. What are these sensations of grief, of anger, of despair, of longing? How do I feel that in my body? Where do I feel that in my body? What effect does it have on my heart, on my mind? These are contemplative questions that lead you into an exploration of what am I actually experiencing? No longer in denial of it, no longer judging it, no longer wishing it were otherwise, but grabbing the bull by the horns, so to speak, and says, this is the way it is. A word for Dhamma, this is the way it is. So let's have a look at it. Can I be with it enough in a way that actually supports my investigation of it? And from that place, wisdom arises. From that place, we come to understand so much more about who we are and who we think we are, so much more about our habitual reactions in relationship, in certain situations, so much more about why the heart mind reacts in that way. And it's from this perspective that we're able to truly consider how we can respond. Wise response is distinctly not a reaction. And we will all find ourselves reacting all over the place. It's habitual. We're habitual creatures. We're programmed. The mind's programmed in many ways. And we've got a lot of karmic patterns. So reactivity will happen. But can we be interested in it from the point of view of wanting to know the truth, of wanting to be free of ignorance, and wanting to understand what is suffering and what is the way to be free of suffering? Because the Buddha clearly said this is the only way to be free, is to understand from the inside out what this experience of pain is about. Only then can we understand the reality of that and the transcendence of that. Does this feel like a good time to finish? And we'll open up for some questions.
So, no, please feel welcome. Any responses, anything you'd like to add, anything you'd like to have us speak about a bit more? No? What would be helpful is that if you have something that you either project your voice a little so we can all, or we can hear up the front. We'll try repeating things, but or you come a bit forward, because it can be hard just to really hear clearly what people are saying. So, yeah, so, and I, as you, some of you know, good. Yeah, so it's a question about how to cultivate the space that would be present for wise response to happen. Yeah? And it's a, you know, I find it a helpful question myself in my practice. You know, what is needed to have enough spaciousness with this, that I haven't contracted around something, you know, the heart hasn't closed, that it can actually relax enough and feel spacious enough to come from a responsive place, you know, as Jitendra was saying, not reactive. And one of the qualities I find, you know, in the heart qualities that really helps with spaciousness, is this quality that is often translated, or usually translated, as equanimity. And it, in Buddhist understandings, it's seen as an understanding of karma, like cause and effect. But how I reflect on it, you know, just simply, is a sense of, you know, as I've been saying on the retreat, that it's an understanding that given the causes and conditions, this could be no other way. Yeah. So when I recognize that about anything, something profoundly relaxes. Yeah. It's this quality of coming out of contention. So if it shouldn't be this way, it wouldn't be this way. So to stop the running, the fighting, the trying to get away, and just, oh yes, how could it be any different, you know, given all that's happened, yeah? But here am I, and when I soften, then, you know, what is needed? Yeah. So it the spaciousness I can for me come from a kind of relaxing, opening, and taking a much larger perspective.
Yeah.
Because what happens when something really hurts, everything tightens around it. So spaciousness is a really lovely quality, you know, it's a lovely word when you think, oh. And even when we're tight, we can feel all the space around us, like in this room, so much space. And can I come out into it a little? You know, and we start this unfurling process. But the equanimity or spaciousness, equanimity, is really this understanding of causality. And it's mostly, it can be so simple. Oh, how could it not hurt? I had such hope.
Yeah.
So it has, it once again, it can have this, it has this compassion in it. Yeah. Is that? Yeah. Chitindriya, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, you touched on, you know, a couple of things I could also mention around the cultivation of some things that can help you find spaciousness. And one of those things is literally noticing space internally and externally, so that it's like training the mind a little bit to notice the space in the room, because where our mind is habituated to go to objects, yeah, we see people, we see mats, we see lights, we see windows, but the space we take for granted, we kind of gloss over. Until we bring our attention to it, we notice the space element. And if you do that even now, you notice, well, it has a very different quality to floor and mat. It's like in sky, you know, sky has that space element. So sometimes, you know, you can really utilize that if you're feeling quite compressed and hurried, and you're looking for how to create a sense of spaciousness. You can actually send your eyes to notice space around you. So that's a helpful thing to know. And similarly, a similar thing can happen internally, to notice the space between things internally. So to slow things down to the point where you can actually start to notice the space between thoughts. And that's slowing things down quite a bit, isn't it? Because sometimes thoughts just are running. But you can do it deliberately. So you hear yourself thinking something like, oh, I feel so bad because of rah, rah, rah. And you catch it and you say, okay, let's slow it down. I feel. And notice the space between each word. And so these are little techniques, but they're actually very powerful. They have a powerful effect on mind. Mind has a powerful effect on the body. You can actually notice a calming influence happening. Calm brings a sense of space. And there was a period in my practice where my buttons were being pushed very strongly, and I was having to practice with kind of eruptions of rage. And I was trying all sorts of ways of dealing with it, because it was very uncomfortable, right? Very unpleasant. But eventually I got to the place where I used this mantra to myself, just if I felt it arise and everything tighten up, I'd say, just give it space. Because really, there's a lot of judgment in my own mind about that, and how desire to get rid of it because it was painful, and you know, mind was judging it to be wrong. I need to get rid of this, it's not right. And so often you don't see those judgments, they're almost assumptions in the movement of the mind, and very typical for spiritual practitioners. What an ugly mind state, I'm so bad, this must be wrong, I have to get rid of it. But actually for Buddhist practitioners, we should be waking up to it, not trying to get rid of it. In the instance, we need to wake up to it, and how to be with that know, for me at that period of time when I said, just give it space, it totally undermined everything that wanted to get rid of it. So the whole internal space was able to open up and relax around it to the degree that I could begin to see more clearly how it was arising and when it was arising. It didn't stop immediately, but the investigation became very, very interesting. And eventually, I gained a lot of insight around it and the whole pattern waned. So, just those things to help.
Yeah, Jerry.
How do you practice with a certain intentionality without turning the practice into some sort of self-improvement program? Like, I need to be bringing a little bit more spacious in this field. I need to do a little more math that there. That's just the dilemma.
So the question is how to practice with some intentionality, like a bit more metta is needed here, or without it becoming a self-improvement plan. Yeah? So, and we all know the self-improvement plan, don't we? You know, the sense that we're not all right and we need to, we pick up the practice to fix ourselves up a bit. You know, and you know, in my experience, the first part of that is recognizing that, oh, I'm practicing, and what starts to happen is I lose heart in my practice. It might take a while, but I start to get, so actually, I don't want to do it. You know, and to me, that is a sign that maybe I've gone back into the improvement plan, which has put a lot of judgment and harshness in it. And so what I find the medicine for that is coming back into the fundamental intention for which the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths, which is this quality of compassion. So it's not that it's not an idea of compassion that I'm doing, it's about coming into my direct experience and reconnecting with that. Yeah? And so I guess one of the big dangers of practice is we practice from ideas. You know? And any idea we lay over the top of anything is usually quite harmful. You know, if we're using them not as inquiries, yeah, rather as a way of deciding what should be happening. So I guess, you know, I hear Jitendriya too, both of us, but she can answer for herself, often just inquiring into what's happening, what's needed. And it's not about this experience being wrong, but it's just what more fully allows me to meet it. Yeah. I don't know if that is helpful, but yeah.
And just something also just to add to that is to recollect from time to time that the Buddhist path isn't about creating the perfect personality. It's actually ultimately about freeing ourselves from the burden of personality, ultimately. And just to remind ourselves from time to time, because I think as spiritual practitioners we can get very down on ourselves, you know, because we've got such a good view of what's going on in here now. It's very easy to judge the mind. So just to recollect that, you know, there's tremendous karmic baggage and that's something we need ultimately to learn how to put down with love and compassion. Just put it down. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's funny, isn't it? You know, going on from what Jitendra is saying is, you know, yeah, personality, but, you know, you'll have seen some of the footage of some of the beings of our, you know, of our lifetimes who have realized profound insight. They can be very grumpy. And they can be
appear very grumpy.
What's it?
They can appear very grumpy.
Well, they can appear very grumpy and appear very sharp. You know? That in a way, personality is vipaka, it's the kind of result. And I guess in a way we do a little bit to tidy it up so it's not so abrasive. But in the end, it's not the point.
Good. Isn't that a relief? I can feel everyone kind of, ah.
Yeah, it is. Yes. You want to lead off?
Talk a bit more about the place of humour and laughter in Buddhism in general, but also what we've been talking about today. Is that right? Okay. So the place of humour and laughter in relation to compassion and wisdom. Well, what attracted me to what was a big attraction when I first went to Amaravati and heard the teachings on a retreat in 1986. And it was Ajahn Amaro, some of you may know Ajahn Amaro, teaching a 10-day retreat, and he told a lot of stories about Ajahn Chah. And what struck me was what a funny man he was, you know, how he taught with great humour much of the time. And that really inspired me, you know. You know, it gave me a sense that his freedom was real. You know, often those beings who have truly found freedom have a great sense of humour and will even send up, you know, and poke fun at those of us who are still suffering. And so Ajahn Chah did a lot. You know, one of the little stories when he used to teach the monks around the monastery. He saw one monk, you know, pull a plug out of the wall, a recording device, pulled the plug out of the wall, and he got an electric shock, and he just dropped it. And Ajahn Chah was on the spot, and he said, "Ooh, who told you to drop that?" As if to say, you know, you felt suffering and you dropped it. That's the teaching. You don't need a teacher to tell you that. You knew it, right? You knew it. And another little story that I love, when in the monastery, again, very casually, he was walking with a monk and a large log had fallen over the path, so he indicated to go and move this log. Monk got on one end and he got on the other, and they lifted, and he looked at the monk, he said, "Is it heavy?" And monk didn't say anything, and they threw it off into the forest, and he said, "Is it heavy now?" See, so his teaching is always pointing, and with such a lovely sense of humour. I don't know how those particular monks felt. They might have felt terribly humiliated, I don't know. But I thought it was very funny, and there's lots of stories like that. And we get it then, don't we? The truth seems to go straight to the heart with that laughter. We wouldn't laugh if we didn't see the truth of it, would we? You know, just we're hanging on to something, and it is easy to let go if we understand when and, you know, how to let go. That letting go is what's needed. You know, I think when we can get to the point of laughing at ourselves, when we see ourselves trip up or, you know, get into a twisted mess over something, when we can laugh a little at ourselves, that's really helpful. That's a good sign. Do you have anything?
Yeah, yes, Lumpur Cha was very funny, you know, and so, you know, if you go on retreat with some people, Most of the time they're just laughing, as you, many of you'll experience. So just that sense of lightness, but not a lightness that's lost track. And it's not unkind. You know, it has this quality of, as Jitendra is saying, of the laughter, the sense of lightness is to allow the letting go. So it's deeply kind. Just helping lighten things a little.
I wanted to ask you to comment more on your phrasing of, I'm not sure if you said you having no heart and what having heart allows, because when you said that, I flashed on a memory of a monk actually telling me, "You have no heart!" So we were being forced to do this walking meditation with holding our breath. It was fierce, and I'm like, "Oh, I can't do it. You have no heart." And I'm tying it to, is it correct? It's faith. And when you were talking about faith, that this can be something that I can
awaken. Yes.
And with effort, but. We could talk more about the having heart and the wisdom of having the heart to do.
So, for people to hear, the question is about having heart or the experience of having no heart. The person who was asking the question was describing an experience of being on the walking path and finding it hard, and a monk saying, "You have no heart." So what from your question I'm hearing a sense of meaning you have no faith. Is that what?
I think,
yes. Yeah. So a sense that how to connect it all up, the sense of the heart, having a sense of confidence that the practice is possible, so that we're willing to do what it takes to actually meet things. You know, so why I connect heart and this quality of faith, confidence, sadha, is that in my experience, it's this, experience of refuge. There is the quality, there is the possibility, we can know the way it is. You know, this is the refuge, the Buddha knowing the Dharma, the three refuges that we can awaken, we are awakening. And so this gives us the heart, the confidence, the love to do what it takes. And it brings with it all this fullness, and with faith, energy gathers, you know, the sense of willingness gathers, and with that there is a sense of mindfulness. We know what is happening. And the mind collects, the quality of samadhi arises, and from that wisdom comes. So we get, in Pali it's called the indriya, they're the five faculties of a mind that is releasing. Yeah? And the first is faith. And at different points the Buddha talks about people having unshakable confidence, a sense that yes, it is possible. Not for somebody else some other time, but for this heart and body now. So it has this real power to it. I'm not sure if I'm quite. Yeah, so. Jitendra?
Oh, just to pick up on the word heart, because it can be used in many different ways, I think. And in this case, it seems to be about the quality of faith and the deepening of faith and confidence, both in oneself, in the practice, and in the possibilities of the practice, leading in the direction of freedom. And sometimes I use the term capacity of heart. In the Buddha's mind, in the Buddha's teaching, you know, citta is the word that often gets translated as heart or mind, and it's citta is also the that which knows, you know, that also the sense of it, within the citta is that sense of the subject experiencing all of this, and the sense of awareness. And so capacity of heart is like building the strength, all the spiritual strengths really, that allow the heart qualities to be strong. And so that includes faith and mindfulness and samadhi and wisdom and the brahmavihara of, you know, kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. So all of these things can be things we can cultivate with some of the practice tools, but they are also things that strengthen as a result of our practice and our experience and our deepening wisdom. So they're things we can develop, and also their results. Yeah.
So probably time for another question, if there is one.
Mary?
But sometimes it's really a scary thought to be in the world.
Did everyone hear Mary's reflection? So just to repeat again, paraphrasing about, she was reflecting on how difficult it is sometimes to receive all the painful news of the world through watching the television, hearing the news, and it really feels like the heart doesn't have the capacity to take that in or digest it. And she was also reflecting a bit of just coming off of a 10-day retreat with us and coming back to the world, and it just feels like so much to take in, and it feels quite difficult for the heart to be so open or opened on retreat and then come back into a place where there's a lot of difficult stuff to digest.
Is that
sometimes? Yeah. And that's certainly true. I also feel that coming off retreat, you know, because we've had such a wonderful supportive environment in noble silence, in a lovely forested setting with everything provided for us, so we can really focus on just meditation. And so things become very simple in many ways. I mean, the mind tries to make it as complicated as possible, but really the external environment is simplifies things as much as possible. So that's it's a wonderful opportunity to go deeply into contemplative practice. But yes, the heart can feel quite open and raw and exposed when coming back into the familiar environment with tremendous stimulation. And my first reflection is that, you know, wow, this is what we live with all the time. You know, and actually the heart learns to shut down and protect itself because it's too much, generally, and people are living with somewhat, you know, protected minds and hearts because there's so much going on and they've got to stay focused. So just to notice the affect of the environment, it's a conditioning factor. So we notice that, and we notice the different kinds of pain that gives rise to. And there are many layers of different kinds of pain. The response to the world news, and then, you know, the thought, I can't bear it anymore, it's a different kind of pain, isn't it? But that ability just to, you know, to bring our contemplation out of the forest into a different kind of forest, actually. This forest is full of a lot more animals and noise and much, much bigger forest, a lot more threatening. So it's very challenging, yeah? So we can only do our best with that, but and try to remember, as we taught so much on that retreat, that it's always about where you're at, here and now. The Axis Mundi is wherever you are at. You know, the true refuge isn't back in the forest retreat, and it isn't anywhere else other than here in your experience. And when you realize actually experience all happens here, it doesn't matter how much noise and chaos is out there, it all happens here. That's a kind of a simplification in itself, so I can be prepared just to recognize what's present now. You know? A bit of frustration, a bit of longing to be back there, you know, a bit of confusion, oh, I don't know what to do with my life, you know, whatever is coming up, but it still happens moment by moment. So that faith is about, actually it is always here. Suffering happens here, but also freedom from suffering happens here. So that gives you the confidence and centers you again, and we have this thing called the body, which is such a burden most of the time, but it is actually a wonderful tool. It grounds you for practice, you know, it earths. And what I've developed and encouraged people is to just say, can I just breathe with this in this moment, whatever it is, despair, frustration, joy, happiness, confusion, tiredness, whatever it is, can I just breathe with this? And that's not that's not something you have to make yourself do. It's an open heart inquiry, a real question. Can I just breathe with this in this moment? Let that inquiry go to the heart and see if you can. And then sit there and see what happens.
Thank you, Jitty. We might leave it there, just so that Jerry's got time to organise rides, because it would be uncompassionate if we left you all stranded here. Yeah? So, thank you. It was a real... It's very lovely to come and see the strength of the engagement with Dhamma here, yeah, and to feel so welcome. So thank you.